So I digress a little bit from the main part of the conversation. First to say, it's nice to know I can find new ways to screw up. After all this time, doing it all for all these semesters, this is not exactly the right set of housekeeping slides. I just created these on the fly in the back. My right set are sitting very nicely on my office computer, not here. I will post, as I always do, the correct set in the housekeeping module, in the learning materials module. So this is housekeeping light. We'll see how it goes. Second, did anybody happen to go over to the sales and career fair just now? Wow, what an exciting event, at least for me. Lots of companies, lots of students. Many of the companies had grads somewhere in my classroom 100 years ago. A lot of energy. I thought that was real. That's sort of why we're here, in part, to see successful people coming back and see y'all getting jobs out there. So that was really slick, I thought. Including, we'll hear later on if we haven't heard yet, from somebody from Saint-Gobain, a company we'll hear about, and Spectrum Charter, who, of course, we hear from here, too. So that was all cool for me as an instructor. And I'm glad you guys went over. Hope you found it interesting. Lecture 11, February 21st, 2023. This begins the material for midterm 2. You're well attuned to that. Or does it? I think it does. All right. So here we are. Mini test 5 opened last Friday. It closes tonight. That was the end of the material for the midterm 1. And as you know, because I've been badgering you about it, midterm 1 opens tomorrow at 8 a.m., covering lectures 1 to 10 and all of the material associated with that. Extra credit number 3 is open on its regular schedule. It closes this Thursday, and then the next one will open. There it is for those of us that like to see it on a calendar, especially with midterm 1 opening at 8 a.m. and closing 8 days later at 5 p.m. Take note of the 5 p.m. Webbies, take note of the 5 p.m. closing, please. It will have been open for 8 days, so I'm not really going to be that amenable to, oh, I didn't know it was open. It's open and closing at 5 p.m. You've seen this before many times by now, so it's just a reminder. And then the details, anybody who hasn't been caught on to it yet, are in past housekeeping slides, in past lectures, and up on Canvas in the Proctorio module. And if you haven't done a Proctorio test ever or want to check your machine, take the sample history quiz. It's a freebie, and if your machine doesn't work, you'll be able to work it out early. Yes, ma'am?
I tried to take it just to see if it was like my whatever was up to date, and it said I needed a code, so it wouldn't let me take it.
Well, 2 comments. Repetitively in messages I've sent you already, ain't no code necessary. Also in the Proctorio help, it says what to do if it asks for a code. If this stupid program, not your fault, asks you for a code, several recommendations. First of all, turn your machine off and reboot it. Get a clean start. Second, do not have any other programs running when you go to take the test. Just the Google or Bing browser to the test. Don't want anything else. Usually, that cleans it up. If it doesn't, you should email me because we've got to get it straight before the test. Sometimes we have to go to Proctorio themselves, who, by the way, are very helpful online. So if asked for code, it does not require a code. It's a glitch in the system. Any other questions? And I'm not yelling at you. I'm yelling at the system. You understand? by George, because I didn't clean up this slide, there it is. So you don't need one. There's the ideas for what to use. Did I say Bing? I meant Microsoft Edge. Or Google Chrome. All right, old info. So this was a very nice story that we had for Business in the News. It's much fancier when I really put it up with the important stuff highlighted. So I'm just going to tell you the story here and now because I brought the wrong slide. I had to create the slides on the fly. So Black History Heroes, this is, after all, Black History Month. How inventor Jan Ernst Metzliger made modern footwear accessible. Fashion students, anybody, you guys study fashion, you also study footwear. Is that a thing for you guys? A little bit? Not really? So, by the way, that's part of fashion, just so you know. chances are you have Jan Ernst Metzliger to thank, at least partially, for the shoes on your feet. He was an immigrant from what is now the country of Suriname in South America, revolutionized the business of shoe manufacturing with a patent he earned in 1883 at the age of 30, an innovation that underlines the methods shoe companies use today. So here's an entrepreneur who was doing some good stuff against racial bias in the 1880s. At one time, the upper part of the shoe was typically stitched to the sole by hand. A cobbler could churn out maybe 50 shoes a day by stretching and stitching process known as lasting. The lasting machine that Metzlinger invented allowed a shoemaker to complete more than 10 times as many shoes a day, according to the Smithsonian. That's a pretty good improvement in productivity. He was truly an entrepreneur, so we talk about entrepreneurship. Doing what he did in the late 1800s, facing such discrimination and racism at the time, says Dwayne Edwards, a former Nike executive who has designed footwear for a bunch of athletes up there. And Dwayne is the founder and president of Pencil Lewis College of Business and Design in Detroit. The point that I didn't have time to recreate here is that he has gotten funding from DSW. We talked about DSW, I think, before. Does anybody know where they're headquartered, that company is headquartered? I had it on the other slide. I'll put it up later. I think they're in Columbus, Designer Shoe Warehouse. Anyhow, they're funding this new company to, I think, the tune of $2 million. And they're going to work with students, black and brown students, at this institution to do the designs for the new schools. It's sort of a new business model for the new shoes. Sort of a new business model. So an entrepreneurial business model. So we're talking about social responsibility. We're talking about a new way of doing things. We're talking about entrepreneurship. A little better on the slide that I had prepared that I was sitting on my office desk at home. This also is a lengthy story that I'm only going to show you a short piece of. This was a great story on some research that they just did out of PricewaterhouseCoopers, PwC, on the state of the consumer market today, important to us. And by coincidence, and this might be why I didn't get it all done as I wanted to, on today's, do you guys watch Cheddar News? Anybody know Cheddar News? I think I mentioned this before. It's focused towards Gen Z, young people doing news. And this news story, which ties very nicely to the information I don't have here, but will put up on the slides that I put on Canvas, talks about what's going on in the mind of the consumer today. So I managed to get this. Hopefully this will work.
Meanwhile, more Americans are curbing their shopping habits. This is the aim to cut their spending, and retailers are taking notice. Major retail companies are cautious about their sales outlook this year. That is, inflationary pressures continue to linger. This predicted shift in consumer behavior, though, a far cry from the initial post-pandemic shopping sprees that many stores thrived on. Now, analysts are saying people are choosing to dine out and travel rather than go shopping.
So retailers in the story that I don't have up there are cutting back on their inventory, having less things to offer the consumer. Now, how do you satisfy your consumer? You may need to change your promotional message to try to share with the consumer alternatives to what it is that they want that you don't have in order to have them buy from this reduced inventory. So it's an interesting marketing retail question, yeah? So I'll make a note of it when I put it up, but it'll be the full slide show will be in our Canvas course. I apologize for not having it today.
We want more, man.
So we pick up. Who knows if I have that right or not? We pick up with some page, probably not that one, in the notes. Any questions for me about the midterm coming up, other than what to do if it doesn't work? Yo. Oh, I'm sorry? If you want in-person testing, you should write to me and request that, and we'll see if we can tie you into some people that have already requested it.
Gotcha.
There's only so many days and times I can open up, and if we can't do that, then we throw our hands in the air and say, I don't know. But give me an email. So this is where we left off last time. And again, what are we thinking about? We're thinking about the idea of industrial marketing, business marketing, B2B marketing, okay, business markets. And right now we're trying to think of the characteristics of organizational buying in the B2B world. So what are some organizational buying objectives? Well, businesses buy from other businesses, B2B, to help them achieve their objectives, which, as I say, is not being sociable, feeling love, being sexy. It's a different set of objectives than we have as individual. If you can get the attention of a potential client or an actual customer in the B2B world and show them how you can reduce their costs and therefore do what to their profits, increase their profits, you probably have their attention. So that's one of the things organizational buyers want. Or turning it around, if you can show them how whatever you're offering to that client, potential or current, will increase their revenues, also arguably increasing their profits, you have their attention. That's another one of their objectives. Or if they're interested in engaging in social responsible activity, and you have a way to help them to do that, they very well may pay attention to you. So these are some objectives that these folks might have that you perhaps as individual consumers in the B2C world don't have. It's a different set of objectives. So if I'm in a B2B world and I'm thinking about who to buy from, how do I decide? Well, in the consumer side of the world, from our consumer model, we have evaluative criteria, those things we feel are important to us, and we're going to evaluate the different alternatives we searched out on them to see which one fits for us. So in deciding among suppliers in the B2B world, buyers have to consider a variety of factors such as, well, price is important to them. They would like to keep their costs down so they can keep their profits up. Delivery schedules. I think we're all attuned to the terrible situation with supply chain problems for businesses, for customers. Can you deliver when you say you're delivering? How have you done in the past with us? Have you been a problem? And with others, if we can get that information. What do your production facilities and capacity look like? I'm planning to grow. I'm planning to go regional, national, international. Can you grow with me? Would be a criteria that I would want to consider. How do you handle and what are your warranties and your claim policies if there's a failure? We go back to Takata airbags failing in a whole bunch of cars, costing them a lot of sales. I don't know what their warranty and claim policies were as a supplier to the automotive industry. I hope the automotive industry knew because it was a huge problem for them. Technical capability. Can you make products to fit my specifications or bring new technology in? So these are the sorts of things that we might look at. Are your quality specs up to what I want them to be? Anybody in management know about ISO? Management types ISO? So ISO is a series of different certifications where you as a B2B marketer are going to tell the industry you have reached certain criteria. Consider me as your supplier. So one of these is ISO 9000. This is standards for registration and certification of my manufacturer's quality management and assurance systems based on an on-site audit of practices and procedures developed by the International Standards Organization. Down here, this is a proud manufacturing company standing. They've just been ISO 9000 and AS9100 certified, and they're standing out there proudly demonstrating they have succeeded. This is something that you as a buyer might want to know about potential suppliers. Why is this also important in the world of B2B buying? Why are these important criteria? Well, obviously, as we know, especially given the supply chain problems of late, firms have to buy the right product, so it has to be available, at the right time, it has to be delivered on time, and at the right price. In general, companies are making for themselves less and less stuff. So they're acquiring more stuff from third parties. For example, Toyota buys outside their own organization $25 billion in parts and supplies a year, probably more by now. You better be sure that those parts and supplies show up in time, at the right price, with the right specs, or you're not selling a bunch of cars. We can't tolerate defective parts or defective supplies because we want them with us as we need them. So this is the idea of just-in-time and just-in-sequence processing. I don't want to hold a whole bunch of inventory that you created 6 months ago in my warehouse. It cost me money. I want you to ship my stuff to me as I need it. This certainly broke down most recently in the pandemic supply chain issue. We didn't have supplies of stuff. And nothing was in the supply chain coming to us because China was shut down due to the pandemic, et cetera, created real problems. So some of this is being rethought. So firms in general need to work with fewer suppliers and develop those suppliers in long-term relationships so that we know they have the technical skills. We know what their delivery policies are. We know that they'll be able to grow as we grow, et cetera. So we work together to develop new products, to share information on our inventories and productions and costs, Information is power. I think you've heard that in general in life, and it's true in business. So we have to trust these suppliers with important information to us. So my additional comment, supply chain problems caused by the COVID pandemic does have business rethinking this concept. We'll see where it goes in the future. So why global supply chains may never be the same, a Wall Street Journal documentary. We can't watch the whole documentary.
Let me check out the soundtrack.
We got this. We got this.
Life is for living.
We got this.
Let's partner for all of it. Edward Jones.
Look at this. Sold out. Can you believe this stuff?
So they were supposed to deliver it in October.
This is going to be an update on the kettlebell shortage of 2020.
I just want my shoe. Give me my shoe, please.
Then it was supposed to be November. No. Then December.
Give me my PlayStation. Am I wrong for wanting this, bro? I mean, everything just...
All right, and on with people complaining about the stuff they couldn't get during the pandemic. So next chapter, we're going to talk about global. There's some interesting thoughts about how we're going to, what the trends are in global today because of this. So because of these relationships we have to have with our suppliers, we need to have, well, good buyer-seller relationships and good supply partnerships. So we need to, just as we develop a relationship with our consumers downstream, we need to develop relationships with our suppliers upstream. That is a deliberate effort by organizational buyers to build relationships that shape our suppliers' products and services and capabilities to fit our needs and those of our downstream customers. So again, just-in-time inventory, JIS is just-in-sequence, where components and parts arrive at the production line right at the time as scheduled, just before they get assembled. And when that works smoothly, it saves us a lot of cost. We don't have to warehouse all this stuff. For example, Maytag has on-site reps at their providers, at their manufacturing plants, to be sure that they're doing what they need to do, and any problems are reported back to Maytag right now, so we're not surprised. In general, when we thought about the B2C world, we thought about you as an individual, your needs, your wants, your desires, yeah? Your evaluative criteria, your attitudes, your beliefs, your buying intention. We cheated a little bit out of that when we talked about family decision-making, a group of people coming together to make a decision. Over here in the B2B world, any important decision isn't made by one individual. They're made by people in the buying center. So the buying center in the B2B world consists of a group of people in an organization who participate in the buying process, who share common risks and goals and knowledge that are important to this purchase decision. It's a cross-functional team, so we have people from finance and accounting and marketing and sales and production all working together on this important, difficult decision. So, who are the people in the buying center? If you're selling to this company, you better know who they are, because you've got to be able to reach them. You better know their individual backgrounds and experiences and biases and agendas, even though up here I said they have common goals. Production may have a different goal than finance. How are you going to sell to both? You have to understand those. What are the roles in the buying center? Well, much like we talked about in the family, there's a gatekeeper there. Sometimes that gatekeeper might be the engineer because it's an engineering sort of production line thing we're going to buy. Sometimes it might be the front desk receptionist. Hi, how you doing? I'm here to sell you some copiers today. Can I talk to the copier person? No, last time he was here, he pissed me off. No, there's nobody here to talk to today. So you have to know who that gatekeeper is, how to reach them, what to reach them with. Technical information for the engineer, brochure information or your sales card for the receptionist, yeah? Influencers, just as we had influencers in our family decision-making process within the organization, there are a bunch of people there who may not actually make the decision but will influence it. Might be the people in finance with some budget thoughts. It might be the purchasing agent who has certain things in mind compared to past suppliers or compared to their criteria. Yes, ma'am.
Never mind.
Okay. The users, who are the users going to be in this business organization, right? It's probably not actually the people doing the buying. It's probably the people down on the shop floor, down in the operations area. If it's copiers, it's the people over in the office areas. Who are they? How are you reaching them with information? How are you setting their expectations, right? And the deciders, which can be tricky. Sometimes the deciders, of course, are the people that you expect them to be within that buying center. There's a great story, though, about a guy who had a sale made. He had sold to the buying center. Everybody knew what was on board. He was happy. He went back to the sales office. He made the sale. He was sure of it. And he didn't get the sale. And he goes back after the fact. He says, I thought this was done. Why didn't I get the sale? Turns out that for reasons we don't know, we don't have the story, the decider, who was the CEO, the decider's wife didn't like the salesperson. Didn't get the sale. A hard one to see, but you have to be aware of these influences that come out of nowhere. And might, so who is influencing the decider other than the formal folks within the organization? When we think about B2B sales, we find there are different types of buying situations that we have to be aware of. We call them buy classes. For example, we have a straight rebuy of an existing product we've bought many times before. Paper towels, pencils, toilet paper, machine oil. We don't go through a full buying center to rebuy paper towels. We talk to the purchasing agent. We say, hey, we need some paper towels. They have a list maybe of vendors, or maybe they have one vendor. They click the button. That's not a real big deal. In fact, if a company is really satisfied with their vendors in a straight rebuy situation, it's sort of hard to get in there. It's just a click of the button. Why should I mess around with a new group of sellers? In the case of something like a modified rebuy, we have a situation where something is new or different. Not entirely new, but a little bit new. There's some new marketer out there. There's some new product offering out there. Here my example is in the world of education. A new textbook might suggest that I should look around and see whether or not I'm happy. Sometimes even ask the students, are you happy with the McGraw-Hill textbook? Because there's a new edition coming out. Are we good? We're not good. So we look around a little bit, and the salesperson might come to me with a new offering and say, hey, it's cost savings, or hey, it's got an additional extra credit opportunity. Oh, well, that's interesting. So a modified rebuy is where we actually have a chance to sell some new stuff because it's a little different. And when we talk about a new buy, that's where you probably have a full range of buying center people involved. So we're talking about buying a robotic production line, and we don't know nothing about no robotic production line. How are we going to do that? We don't know anything. Everybody in the buying center, we better get together and make this decision together and understand all the details. How much information do they need on a straight rebuy from you as a marketer? Not very much. They already got you set. How much do they need if it's a totally new buy for a product like this? They need the full array of information, the website, the brochures, the salespeople, the technical people, the support people. All have to be in there talking to them. What sort of situation are you in as you go to sell your product to this company? Yeah? This is just a write-up on this topic from a figure in the book, chapter 6, item 4. So in a straight rebuy, people involved, one, usually the purchasing agent. Decision time is short. They look through the list and press a button. Problem definition, you don't have to worry about too much. What is toilet paper again? I don't quite get that. Well, what is that? Well-defined problem. Buying objectives, mostly a low-priced supplier that you know and trust. You usually look at the existing suppliers because it's not that big a deal. And the buying influence, again, is the purchasing agent. In a modified rebuy, there might be a couple people involved. In my example, the textbook, maybe I wander over to the chairperson of the department or to somebody else teaching marketing. And I say, hey, have you heard about this new edition? What do you think? Not a full-blown enterprise thing, but there we go. Decision time is a little longer. Problem definition, well, it's minor modifications. There's something new out there for our product. The buying objectives might still be the low-priced supplier, given the new information. Suppliers, I would change at present and some possibility of some new. And the buying influences the purchasing agent and other people. And finally, in this new buy situation, many people involved, the full buying center. It's complex. We don't know the companies. We don't know the criteria. We don't know anything. Long decision time. Problem definition, we don't really understand what it means to have a robotic production line. How about a robotic professor? Hi, I'm your artificial intelligence professor. I do not forget slides on my office desk. Buying objectives, you want a good solution, not necessarily the lowest price. Suppliers consider both new and present, and the buying influence is, I'd say, the full buying center. Technical people, operating people, etc. This is trying to do a little bit of a comparison to help you see what the decision process looks like in the B2C world as you consider buying a smartphone, and the B2B world as they consider coming up with a new earbud headset for a smartphone. So in your world, problem recognition, you don't like the features of your smartphone. You want a new one. You. It's all about you. Information search, you use your past information and experience. Maybe you talk to friends, ads, the internet. Maybe look at consumer reports. You get some information. You figure out what the new alternatives might be. Alternative evaluation, you consider those things that came into your evoked set on the basis of whatever's important to you. And you look maybe at a bunch of either physical stores, kiosks, online websites, depending what you're talking about. Purchase decision, you choose a brand. You select it. You pay the price. You take the product. You get it shipped to you. Post-purchase behavior, you evaluate the purchase decision. And if you don't like it, you send it back. I'm just curious, how many folks have bought a new smartphone in the last year or so? Anybody? So what did you look for? I'm just curious, did you have any criteria in mind that made you buy the new smartphone?
I wanted a cool color.
Cool color. Okay, and so you looked at some, did you only look at one brand or did you look across other brands? Just Apple, but you want a new color. I saw a hand over here. New phone. Decided to take your hand down. Maybe you were scratching. All right, so in this case, the process was driven by, well, I want this brand, but I want a new color. It's going to drive me there. And you bought it. Were you satisfied? What color did you get?
I got light pink.
Uh-huh. Okay, so there we go. On the other hand, it's a little different in the world of B2B, right? So we're here, we decide that we're going to buy a new earbud headset for one of our smartphones. Why? Well, first, marketing research and sales see that competitors are improving the earbud headsets on their phones. We think we should improve ours too. So we're going to need to purchase this from an outside supplier. We begin to look around. Design and production engineers draft our specs for the headsets. The purchasing department identifies suppliers of earbud headsets. Evaluation, purchasing and engineering personnel go out and visit suppliers. They assess things we've talked about, the facilities, their capacity, the quality control, the financial status. And they drop out anybody that doesn't seem to work. Purchase decision, in the B2B world, they use quality, price, delivery, technical capability as key criteria. Negotiate a contract and award a contract, which we don't do usually in the B2C world. And they evaluate suppliers using a formal vendor rating system. Any problems, they notify the supplier if there's a problem. And if they can't correct it, they're out. So a little more formal process in the B2B world that we have to be aware of. A true, if somewhat old example, how many chocolate lovers here just in general? Chocolate, okay. Hershey's, maybe not the finest quality chocolate in the world, but still tasty, affordable. Hershey's is out there looking around, and they begin to recognize a problem a few years ago. And the problem they recognize is diabetes. Diabetes turns out to be a major problem among American consumers. 18 million people had diabetes whenever I put this together. And there was a 10% growth rate in diabetes annually. So what did consumers want? Well, they'd like some nice, tasty product that doesn't have sugar in it, because sugar is what drives your diabetic condition into a bad state, yeah? All right, so Hershey's thinks about this, and they say, well, I'd like to find something to help these people out. I'd like to find something that has the right sugar substitute, so they're out looking for information. So I don't know the real technical details, but they had to define their specifications. It had to appeal to consumers in terms of taste and texture and dietary needs. It had to be easy to use. It had to be available in sufficient quantities for us to put it into our production. It had to have the right cost. They went out and found a bunch of potential vendors, so marketing and production and research people jointly evaluated the possible vendors out there. Maybe they also went out and contacted university food science researchers for more information about sugar substitutes. They got rid of all those that didn't have the taste and the texture of sugar, that were too expensive, that couldn't be provided in adequate quantities, etc. They decided to make a purchase decision of a vendor. They bought the sugar substitute. They integrated it into the marketing mix for new sugar-free products, and they marketed those out to consumers. And then they did post-purchase evaluation. They went to see if the products sold well or not. And indeed, they did okay. So we have Jolly Rancher sugar-free, Reese's sugar-free, Twizzler sugar-free, Hershey's chocolate candy sugar-free, Hershey's sugar-free syrup. We've helped an entire segment of the population enjoy our fine product without suffering from diabetic shock, without sugar. So they went through this entire process based on a problem that they recognized, selecting off a vendor and getting it successful product out to marketplace. So they asked themselves after the fact, how well did the supplier of the sugar substitutes do? Did we need any problems, anything to be fixed? And how successful were they in the new marketplace? They did pretty well. So there's a B2B example. Online buying is big in the B2C world, you know that, but it's also big in the B2B world. We have a lot of online buying in organizational markets in the B2B world through e-marketplaces. We have online auctions in organizational markets. In a traditional auction, we have a seller that puts up an item for sale and various buyers bid in competition on that product. The more bidders you get, the more upward price pressure there is. The auction ends when there's a single bidder. How many of you guys in the B2C world have bid on something online? Yeah, what platform? Okay, so for example, eBay was maybe what you said, but anyhow, so you put in a bid, somebody else puts in a bid, you go back and check it, you bid it up. Of course, I think eBay lets you buy it at a price point right now, but if not, it goes up and up, and you drop out, or you buy it, you win. So, did you win? No. All right, so the price bid up and up, and finally I say, I don't want it. That goes on a much bigger scale in the world of B2B marketing, okay? This idea of auctions. For those who like visual learnings, here's one seller of a product. And as the number of buyers over here increase, you can see the price goes up and up because they're bidding against one another, right? There's another form of auction that occurs in the B2B world, and that's a reverse auction. In a reverse auction, a buyer says, hey, I need this product or I need this service. Various suppliers look at the offering and they bid in competition to be the supplier. But here, as you get more and more suppliers, what happens? They bid lower and lower to provide the product or service that this buyer wants. So there's a downward pressure on price. And in this case, the auction ends when there's a single bidder, a single supplier left. I did a while ago, maybe it was during the terrible time before the housing bubble burst, I did see a B2C version of this. There were a mom and dad sitting in a kitchen table, and they had a line of guys in business suits sitting in their hallway going up to their kitchen table, and there was a guy sitting across from them, and he was a banker, and he was going to offer them a finance loan, and obviously they were offering the lower and lower loan rates. They were bidding each other for lower loan rates. Not a big problem today since we're going the other way, but that was a little bit of reverse auction in the B2C world. It also occurs in the B2B world. So here we see lots of sellers. The more sellers you have, the lower the price goes down, and finally there's only one left, and the buyer buys from that lowest cost provider that, of course, meets all their specs. And here's actually a document on reverse auction, saving money and increasing transparency. So it's out there as a document if one is interested in it. Okay, so that is organizational, seeing our organizations and businesses as customers and clients, and the end of that chapter. And hopefully what we've seen is a difference between the B2C world and the B2B world. Still at a pretty high level above what we do every day when we're hired into an organization, we're going to think about another strategic approach. That we might have in doing business, and this is the idea of global marketing. So we're understanding and reaching global consumers and markets, chapter 7, lecture outline, page 101. So you hear a lot about global, especially these days. Why is it so important? Why is international trade so important? Well, we say to get access to materials and or products and or services which are not available domestically, or which may be available domestically but at a higher price or lower quality or with low technology. What are you going to do? You're going to look around, and you may very well want to buy from another country. Or you want to get access to markets that are out there and want your products, services, materials. They're asking, please, sell to us, even though we're not in your country. Okay, maybe look at that. Or because some countries of the world have comparative advantages. We'll talk more about this. But by and large, if you want to buy diamonds, where are you going to buy diamonds from? Where do they originate? Where are they found? Where? Yeah, Africa. Now we have a whole other issue of blood diamonds and that. But ignoring that, you can't very well go to Ohio, to the diamond mine in Ohio. It's not a thing. Countries have different comparative advantages. That's why you go to them. So some countries have unique national or human resources that give them a competitive edge internationally, and we want that competitive edge for our country. So, our market at home is saturated. How many more Starbucks do we need in New York City or anywhere else in the U.S., right? Where's the nearest Starbucks to us right here? Where? On camp, right down, right in the College of Business. But where's the next closest? I think right down the hill. Do they still have one in the library? Yeah. How many more Starbucks do you need in this market? I think we're covered. Maybe we should go somewhere else. How many more do you need in the U.S.? Our market's saturated. Maybe we should grow globally. Potential demand. We know that there's an area of the world that's growing in terms of economics or in terms of population or in terms of business. So maybe they're a good place for us to go. And our customers are going internationally themselves. They expect us to be able to supply them internationally. Or else they're going to choose a different company, a different supplier. So maybe we should think about that, supplying our customers. The pandemic, we can't get away from it, has had some interesting influence on all of this. The pandemic led to a surge in online spending, we know, in the biggest shopping revolution in the West since malls and supermarkets. But it's China, not the West, where the future of e-commerce is being staked out. The China market is bigger, more creative, and tech firms there are blending e-commerce, social media, and more to become the online shopping business for 850 million digital consumers. What's the U.S. total population? 330 million. This is 850 million, not just total population, because it's bigger than that. Digital users. Might there be an opportunity there? Interesting. The China e-commerce market overtook the U.S. market in 2013, and today is worth more than $2 trillion, more than the U.S. and Europe combined. The China e-commerce market is dynamic and highly competitive, leading to innovation, such as demolishing the boundaries between different types of services that are still common in the West. They blend digital payments, group deals, social media, gaming, instant messaging, short-form videos, and live streaming celebrities in single platforms. In the West, Visa specializes in payments, Amazon in e-commerce, Facebook in social media, Google in search. The West, this comment is largely underestimating China when it comes to the future of global e-commerce. The future is still coming. We'll see what happens. Multinational firms like Unilever, L'Oreal, and Adidas make more revenue in Asia than in America. And they look there, not to California or Paris, to see the latest in digital marketing, branding, and logistics. To be competitive, some Western companies are diversifying. Facebook promotes shopping services on its social networks and engages in social commerce, including live streaming and the use of WhatsApp for messaging between merchants and shoppers. Walmart hosted its first live shopping event using TikTok, which, as you know, is a somewhat controversial Chinese-owned app. From electronics to solar panels, Chinese manufacturer advances have been ignored or dismissed as copied by the West, then downplayed, and then grudgingly acknowledged around the world. Today, it is the Chinese consumers' tastes and habits that are going global. seems like global might be important for us to think about. Also, from an economic viewpoint, we do think about the balance of trade. We remember that from macroecon, balance of trade issues, vaguely. So, what is the balance of trade? Well, it's the difference between the monetary value of a nation's exports and imports. Off the top of your head, does the U.S. export more goods to other countries, or does it import more goods from other countries? They do which? They import more than they export. Exactly so. And we see this in our little map here. So we see what? We see that imports are in the green. Exports are in the orange. Pandemic has messed with our trends a little bit. But if you look at the overall trend, what would you say the trend is for exports? Up, down, or steady in general across time? Up. In general, the trend is up for exports. What's the trend in general for imports over time? Also up. That's sort of interesting. So what we see is exports are up and imports are up, but imports are up more than our exports. And so what does that do to our balance of trade? It's negative. Now, that's a policy issue. Let me point out, as a business person, as a marketer, there's money to be made in import. There's money to be made in export. I would let the policy makers worry about the balance of trade. I would see if there's a business opportunity for me either to import or to export, if that's in my mission. Let the government worry about the balance of trade issues. We are certainly excited to import stuff in Ohio. We're certainly excited to have companies here and global companies here and work in Ohio. Ohio is the 9th largest exporting and 11th largest importing state in the nation. Who knew? Within a one-day drive of most U.S. metros, says our little promo, the Cincinnati region's location means more products arrive at the customer's door faster. Our strong logistics industry moves large and small items via air, river, rail, or road. Foreign direct investment in the Cincinnati area. Ready Cincinnati offers a one-stop shop for businesses looking to scale in the American marketplace. So if you want to come to America, pay attention to us. And here's some foreign firms that operate in our area. Also, Jobs Ohio, international investment. Companies abroad benefit from Ohio's strengths. Come and invest, oh, foreign companies here in Ohio. So, we are certainly interested in encouraging folks to come here to do business. When we think about world trade, we can look at it from something called the Comparative Advantage of Nations, written about by a well-known Harvard Business School instructor, Michael Porter. And he talks about the Michael Porter's diamond of world trade, okay? And what he's asking and trying to answer is, why do some industries and firms become world leaders, and why do others lose ground or fail? And he says you can analyze this by thinking about things in this diamond shape. You can look at the interaction between firm structure, strategy, and rivalry, demand conditions in the country you're thinking about dealing with, the related and supporting industries that might be in a country, and a variety of factor conditions. And if you're a business, you should think about these elements. So for example, factor conditions, things like natural resources, right? So we said a minute ago, if you want to source diamonds, Ohio's not the right place to be. You're going to have to go to Africa, right? So there are a lot of resources like that. What about the education and skills levels of potential consumers and of potential workers? How does that look as you think about going to this country? What about the wage rates? Currently, we are, and this gets complicated and it's not going to be entirely clear on the slides that are coming up, we're fussing between being global on the one hand, doing everything out of, say, China, which hasn't worked well for us recently, But there's still a lot of companies and investment there. In part, why? One reason, wage rates of workers, yeah? However, given the new thought about regionalism, where are we thinking about doing some business outside the United States but not China that's closer to us? Mexico. So Mexico is a growing supplier, business partner for us. Interestingly, I just heard today on NPR, interestingly, the wage rates in Mexico are just about the same as the wage rates in China, which surprised the heck out of me. So if you were doing business in China, and now you're thinking about where else can I do business to get around some of these global supply chain issues, workers in Mexico don't get paid that much more. And by the way, your shipping costs are a heck of a lot closer to the U.S. if that's your market, because you're here. Kuwait specializes in the production of oil, not so much steel and diamonds. Hollywood, if you want to get engaged in film production, where might you consider going? Well, there's a concentration of skilled labor and excellent film schools in the area. Maybe that's where you go. Of course, in addition to Hollywood, globally, what's another place that makes a boatload of films? Yeah? India, what do we call it there? Not Hollywood, but Bollywood. Boatload of actors, boatload of film companies there. But after that, where else are you going? Argentina? Maybe not. So what's the natural resources, education, skills level, and wage rates? Japan is an island nation, yes, without a rich foundation on their island of raw materials. They just don't have it. They're a small island country. So over time, in order to be successful in the modern industrial world, they had to make the most they could out of the limited resources they had, because getting anything to their island is expensive and they don't have it naturally, resulting in their focus on miniaturization, making things smaller and smaller. They created the idea of just-in-time inventory delivery and zero-defect manufacturing because of their lack of natural resources. So as you think about doing work in a country, you would consider these factor conditions. Can we produce and sell in this country? Better than be thinking about these factors as you think about that, yeah? Also, interrelatedly, what about the demand conditions? How big is this market? How big in terms of numbers of people? How big in terms of spending power? How much money do they have to spend? How sophisticated are the consumers? We talked, I think, one day already, did we not, about the marketing of baby food in Africa, right? Where many people are illiterate, but they still have to shop in stores. They can't read what's on the package, how they know what's on the package. Pictures. Gerber's takes their baby food product to Africa, showing pictures of babies on the jars, and the readers thought it had ground up babies, not a real big salesperson, a selling feature. So what is the sophistication level of your consumers? What do you have to put on the labels? What do you have to put on your website? What do you have to put in your brochures? What do you have to tell your salespeople? What is the media exposure habits of the consumers in this area? For example, in general, German consumers have demanded a high level of engineering in the cars that they buy in Germany. So companies like Mercedes and BMW and Porsche have done very well there. That's what those consumers, not everyone, but a large segment, want. And that's allowed them to dominate the world in these high performance cars. In general, they don't do well in the cheap mass-produced car market. German consumers don't much care for them. That's not their specialty. So they're driven a bit by the demand characteristics. Is there a demand for your product in this country compared to other choices? Seems like an important thing to ask. Interrelated is the idea of, are there related and supported industries there? What about the existence of supplier clusters? You're going to go produce in this country. Can you get support for whatever it is you're producing? While companies are moving their production somewhat out of China, somewhat to Mexico, including, by the way, Chinese major marketers are leaving China and putting manufacturing plants in Mexico to sell to the U.S., But logistics there, road, rail, supporting services, not so good. There are national strengths associated with clusters of industry. Silicon Valley in the U.S. has an advantage if you're going for that technology. In Germany, they have clusters around chemicals. That's something that you can find a lot of suppliers if chemicals are necessary in your particular production. So wherever you're thinking about going, can you get support from suppliers in this country? Are you going to have to work it all out on your own? Not so good. And finally, company strategy, structure, and rivalry. As you're thinking about going to this country, how many other companies are already there? They've been doing just fine without you there all this time. How many are already out there? Who are you going up against? How intense is the competition in your particular area that you're going up against? Are the companies that you're going to be competing with publicly owned or privately owned? Are they government funded? You're going to go try to make a profit against an entity that's government funded, because that's the way it works in that country. Not so good. Competition can drive innovation and upgrades. Japan had 9 major car competitors in this small country plus foreign markets, and it drove them to be very innovative against competition. First cup holder in the world, Toyota. How many cars have cup holders today? It's a major thing. But when it came out, it was a new idea. So they were struggling against competition. Can you be competitive in this country of the world? Questions we should be thinking about, questions we should be answering before we decide to go international. So firms that succeed in global markets have first succeeded in intense domestic competition through continuous improvement, through innovation, by managing change. And those are things that they're going to take forward as they consider going to do business in other parts of the world against the factors in Porter's diamond. I digress when I say, over at the career fair today, there were a couple companies in there that are represent our video guest speakers. So one of them was Spectrum Charter. There was a guy over there looking for interns and employees. Another one, global company, Sangoman, as represented by Norton, was over there as well. So we'll be talking about these guys, Norton and Sangoman, here shortly. So what are the trends in today's economic world? Whatever I say here is subject to change depending on the policy today. It gets confusing. So, issues of economic protectionism. As you know, perhaps, the prior U.S. administration favored economic protectionism. In comparison, the current administration is more in favor of open trade. Politicians are funny creatures. They do affect our business. Should Congress use political situations as a reason for more protectionism to keep out foreign investment, to keep out imports, etc.? Some politicians argue that the benefit of today's relatively free trade system go out unfairly to primarily low-wage countries and that this takes jobs away from Americans. Depending on which set of facts you want to look at, this isn't supported by the facts of the situation. America's economy over the last few decades has proved that openness, coupled with flexibility, makes the economic pie much bigger and the benefits can be widely shared. So we would argue more open trade, more import, more export, growing opportunities for everybody here and there is one position. Ronald Reagan, who, as you may or may not remember, was a Republican, said, look, a creative, competitive America is the answer to a changing world, not trade wars that would close doors, create barriers, and destroy millions of jobs. Remember, protectionism is destructionism. You can do your own research. That's what this president said. Now, in the world today, where are we? Well, it's hard to keep up. The China-United States trade is an ongoing economic conflict between China and the U.S. In 2018, President Donald Trump began setting tariffs and other trade barriers on China with the goal of forcing it to make changes to what the U.S. says are unfair trade practices. And I wouldn't actually argue that China is not engaged in some unfair trade practices. They are. Among those trade practices are, and their effects are, the growing trade deficit. Well, I'm not sure that's the critical part. The theft of intellectual property, absolutely a true problem. And the forced transfer of American technology to China. If you're going to manufacture and sell in our country, you have to share your technology with us and our manufacturers. Not that fair. The trade war itself negatively impacted the economies of both the U.S. and China. In the United States, it led to higher prices for consumers and financial difficulties for farmers and manufacturers. In China, the economic growth and growth of manufacturing activity slowed to their lowest rates in decades. In other countries, this whole trade war has also caused economic damage, though some countries in turn benefited from the increase in manufacturing to fill the gaps. So Mexico might actually be benefiting as companies are moving there to do manufacturing because of the problems we have with our relationship with China. China has been GM's largest retail sales market since 2012. I don't know if that's a no-brainer for you, really? A favorable relationship between the U.S. and China is important for maintaining its business relations within the country. The pandemic and a weakening Chinese economy and trade wars with the U.S. have obviously impacted their sales in a negative way. That's not good for U.S. GM is not doing well. So, GM sales in China and the U.S., here we see it by year, 2018 to 2021, the last time I had data for. And we see that as we came into the trade war issue and then into the pandemic, sales went down and down, relatively speaking. Although, still bigger in China than in the U.S. So, GM at least would like to see us have better relationships. So when we talk about protectionism, what are we talking about? Well, there are two key ways of protecting your economy from those nasty outsiders. One is through tariffs, and one is through quotas. So in general, tariffs act to increase the price for consumers. So tariffs are a government tax on goods or services entering a country, and their primary purpose is to increase the cost of the product coming in. Economic theory says if the price is higher, what's going to happen to demand? It'll decrease. So we're going to import less products because the price is higher. Who, by the way, pays for a tariff? Is it that foreign country or is it our country, the U.S.? Who pays for the tariff? Fifty-fifty chance of being right here, folks. 50-50 chance. Take a wild guess. You aren't going to lose any money on it. How many people agree that the foreign country pays the tariff? How many people agree to that? How many people feel it's the U.S. economy, U.S. consumers, that pay the tariff? So the idea that the foreign company pays the tariff is a commonly held idea and wrong. That tariff is a tax put on the U.S. companies importing the goods. And then who pays for that? Presumably, unless those companies are willing to take a reduced profit, U.S. consumers pay for it. And the idea is protect our own boundaries, right? Higher price, lower demand, you won't buy as much stuff. Or we can go the other way to protect our economy through quotas. What are quotas? A restriction placed on the amount of a product that can either enter our country or leave our country, yeah? So what is the effect of tariffs and quotas on world trade? What would you say the effect probably is? I'll take any answer. Yeah. Boom. Whether we're talking about tariffs or quotas, the net effect, are you an economist? The net impact is to decrease world trade. Maybe that helps your world view somehow. Maybe that helps your governmental view somehow. It's not so good for business. Nobody wins that from the viewpoint of dollars spent, profits made. Going back a little bit to take a historical perspective on this issue, anybody ever hear of GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade? So we are going back quite a way, but it's historically useful to know where some of this stuff comes from. It comes out of World War I, and it's a treaty among these countries. It's not an organization, it's just on paper an agreement between, most pertinent between 47 and 94. It's still technically in effect. At the time, services were not a big deal. So we're focused on merchandise trade, and it was agreements on how we should trade with other countries of the world, what the rules would be, yay, but there was no mechanism for dealing with conflict or disputes. So if you were cheating, or I said you were cheating, and you say, no, I'm not, there was no way to determine what was going on. Not great. How many of you guys have heard of the WTO? Okay. This organization comes in to try to fix some of the underlying problems with the GATT, which again, technically is still around. Some of the goals of the World Trade Organization is, ideally, they recognize it's a push. Trade without discrimination. Everybody trades with each other on an equal footing. No special deals, special arrangements, tariffs, quotas. Everybody freely trades. They recognize that's pretty optimistic. So they are willing to cede that regional trade agreements, like the US-Canada-Mexico trade agreement, like the EU, right, are okay. Predictable and growing access to markets. If we're going to have tariffs, everybody has the same dealio, and we don't mess around with them. We don't give it one day to you, and a different day to you, and a different day to you, and change them around, and then we come back to you and do a different deal. What is that? How do you do business internationally? So they say predictable and growing access to markets, promoting fair competition. They want large and small countries to do well in international trade, that's their domain, through fair competition. And they would like to encourage economic development and economic reform to be fairer. Three quarters of the members are in developing countries. Of course, most of the world is developing countries. So they would like to see those developing countries do better. Doesn't seem like a terrible idea to me. So that's their view of the world. The guy I'm going to bring up here, and I have enough time, he drones on a little bit, I admit it. Patrick Lowe is the retired chief economics officer of the World Trade Organization. He used to teach for Kent State University in Geneva, in our Geneva program. And so you could actually hear from the chief economics officer of the World Trade Organization in one of your classes at Kent State. When he gets on camera, he goes very monotone, and he's going to drone on and on about what the organization wants because he knows he's on camera, so I'm sorry he's going to do that. But he nonetheless has some interesting points to make about the WTO. So we're going to listen to him drone on for a little bit as we learn more about his view of the World Trade Organization.
My name is Patrick Lowe. I'm the chief economist at the World Trade Organization. We are an international trade agreement amongst a highly diverse and quite large membership of 150 members. So ours is an agreement. We're not a funding institution of any kind. We're a place where governments come to talk about trade policy, to agree on rules about trade policy, and to agree about the conditions of access to each other's markets. I expect the Commission to take a fresh look at some of the pressing issues facing the multilateral trading system today, and the trading system more generally, international trade relations more generally. In many ways, we're at turning points in the conduct and organization of international trade, and this is an opportune moment for some knowledgeable outsiders, most of the Commission are outsiders, to give some new insights, some fresh insights, different ways of looking at things. It's a multidisciplinary body, and that has huge advantages too. Trade and increasing integration through trade is one of the key features of globalization today. So cooperation is at a premium. And the challenge we have is to make sure that this is a kind of cooperation from which we get buy-in from all nations, all interests. And that is very easy to say and rather hard to do. Interests are diverse, priorities are different. And the question is, how can we bring all these diverse interests together in a way that leads to mutual benefit among the cooperating parties? Bilateralism and regionalism more generally has exploded exponentially in the last decade or two. And it does raise the question of what the role of the multilateral trading system, the so-called non-discriminatory basis of the multilateral trading system, is obviously challenged by regional and bilateral agreements. But these regional and bilateral agreements exist for a reason. Governments have seen it in their interests to strike these agreements. I think our job as the, if you like, the core focal point of international trade relations among almost all nations is to play for coherence, to try to ensure as much coherence as possible in these different arrangements, to try to see if we can make a contribution to minimizing the costs involved in crisscrossing arrangements, often competing in many ways, a situation where a pair of countries will negotiate something and then one of those countries will then negotiate something with somebody else, and that will immediately depreciate what was negotiated in the first agreement, and all the mess that follows from complex networks of rules of origin and differentiated conditions of market access. Even though it's clear that governments see value in making these agreements, I think there is an awareness that they're not always the best way of carrying forward harmonious and integrated international trade relations of the kind that the WTO seeks to promote. On the other hand, it's a lot easier sometimes to make agreements among a few countries rather than try to get a universe of countries to agree on things. I think one of the big challenges for the WTO is to ensure that these don't become excessively discriminatory against outsiders. As far as possible, they should be open and inclusive, not exclusive and discriminatory, even if in their fundamental nature they have some discrimination in them. Can we look to a future where this crisscrossing network of agreements will eventually become more generalized into multilaterally oriented agreements, where we'll be able to eliminate some of these efficiency costs and difficulties associated with overlapping and potentially excluding agreements. Some developing countries have gone quite a long way in establishing regional agreements amongst themselves, but I think many of them rely very heavily on the multilateral trading system as a bedrock of international rules, where governments make pre-commitments to certain types of policy behavior. I think many developing countries would be quite concerned if they thought that regional arrangements were simply going to substitute for the multilateral trading system. So I think they look to the multilateral trading system to provide stability and continuity and a certain degree of predictability that is not necessarily present in regional arrangements.
Okay, whoops, so he goes on and talks more about this stuff, but you can fill in the blanks. WTO agreements... WTO agreements create an environment of stability, continuity and predictability, and equality and fairness in trade. He's much more fun in person. So the last time I was there a number of years ago, I took out the class of students that I was with. We bought him a wine. He bought us some beer. We bought more beer. We bought more wine. I gave him some cheap KSU sunglasses. So those are the blue ones. And so here we are out with him having a few beers, the chief economist of the World Trade Organization, and a group of students outside his place in Geneva, Switzerland, and out to dinner that he bought. Thank you for that. So there are 150 countries in the World Trade Organization. Have you ever tried to get agreement on a team of, you know, with 6 or 8 people on your team? How hard is that? Go try to get agreement among 150 countries. good luck. So that's always been a problem with this particular organization. How many countries are there in the world? 495? 195? How do you know that? So, indeed, there are 196 countries in the world, only 150 in the WTO, unless you don't count Taiwan, which makes it 195, you're exactly right. So, Taiwan is not considered an official country by many, which would bring the count down to 195. Although Taiwan operates as an independent country, many countries, including the U.S., don't officially recognize it as one. Because the People's Republic of China considers Taiwan a breakaway province of China. Countries who wish to maintain diplomatic relations with China have had to sever their formal relationships with Taiwan. More than 100 countries, however, have unofficial relations with Taiwan. So, 150 of the 196 countries are members of the WTO. Go try getting agreement among all of them on some international trade agreement. All right, I think that's as far as we'll get today. We'll continue this march about marketing in today's economic world next time. Don't forget that tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., Midterm 1 opens. Yay! Woo! Okay, thank you.